Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Imagine this. A frantic 911 call comes in. Officers are dispatched, and, within minutes, they're on scene. Most of us probably picture them speeding, lights and sirens, straight to the location, right? But what actually happens? Like, what's going through an officer's mind, or even happening in their patrol car, before they've even pulled up? It's way more intricate than just showing up. From the very second that call is made to the officer's arrival, and every single decision after that, there's this complex web of procedure, legal stuff, and, split-second choices. Today, our deep dive is designed to unravel those intricate layers. We want to look at law enforcement's initial response, revealing the kind of blueprint officers navigate every single day. We're going to walk through this process step by step, trying to make sense of how police respond to a call. Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah, and what's fascinating here is that we're going to be drawing heavily from a specialized training document, the Call Response Handout.pdf. And this isn't just some basic manual. It pulls its insights directly from really foundational legal texts like Weston and Wells, Criminal Investigation, Basic Perspectives, plus various sections of the Code of Criminal Procedure, the Penal Code, and some crucial landmark Supreme Court cases. Our mission today really is to demystify police call response for you, the listener. We'll cover everything from, like you said, the moment a call comes in, through those critical steps of securing a scene, all the way to understanding the constitutional limits on what police can actually do. We're going to try and break down these complex legal concepts, make them accessible and clear so you can truly grasp the foundational principles that guide officers, even if you're kind of new to these topics.
That's a perfect setup. So let's dive right into the very beginning, right? A call for service comes in. What are the immediate considerations for an officer, even before they arrive at a scene? What's going through their mind in those critical seconds?
Well, the sources make it crystal clear right from the outset. No call is ever truly routine. That immediately highlights the need for, constant vigilance. Pre-arrival tactics, they're heavily focused on officer safety and strict adherence to department policy. This includes really stringent guidelines on driving, vehicle operation, and maintaining constant, clear communication with dispatch. That communication piece is key. Officers are specifically advised to always be watching for fleeing suspects even before they get near the location.
Fleeing suspects even before they arrive. How does that work?
Yeah, exactly. They might be coming from the scene as the officer is approaching. So awareness is high from the start. And a key piece of tactical advice, and this might surprise some people, is to actually park away from the immediate location and approach on foot.
Park away, not right in front.
Right. The handout specifically warns, and this is a direct quote, "If you find yourself in front of the location, don't stop. Keep driving." It really emphasizes how critical it is for officers to know the local geography, block numbers, things like that, to execute a safe tactical approach. It's about not putting themselves or others at a disadvantage right from the beginning.
Wow, keep driving. That's counterintuitive.
It is, but it's about control. Whether it's an in-progress event, meaning it's happening right now, or something that just occurred, officers are constantly assessing the layout, potential escape routes, any immediate danger cues. The idea is to control the approach rather than letting the scene control them.
So it's about tactical positioning and awareness from the absolute start, almost like a chess game before they even step onto the board. What happens once they've arrived? They're now physically on the scene. How do they transition from that careful approach to initial action?
Well, upon arrival, that cautious approach absolutely continues. Officers are immediately alert for any unusual activity. Suspicious people, unexpected vehicles, or suspects actively at, near, or leaving the scene. Their priorities then quickly shift to determining several critical factors. Are suspects present? Okay, how many are there? Are weapons involved or potentially involved? And maybe most importantly, do they need to request backup immediately? These are fast, dynamic assessments that directly influence their very next actions.
Right, like a rapid-fire risk assessment.
Exactly. It informs every subsequent move they make.
That paints a vivid picture of those immediate challenges. You mentioned certain calls are never routine, and I imagine some carry even higher risks. What about something like, say, a robbery in progress? That must be an entirely different level of intensity.
Oh, absolutely. Robbery scenes are specifically highlighted in the source material. They have an increased chance of an officer involved in a shooting. So this necessitates extreme caution and a fully tactical response from the moment that call comes in. Even if a suspect has already fled the scene, the location itself or maybe their flight route can still pose a significant danger. You just don't know. The primary objective always is to avoid hostage situations.
Avoid hostages? How do they try to do that?
Well, it means, if at all possible, confronting robbers outside, not trying to go inside after them, to make the scene safe for both police and any civilians who might be present or nearby. It's actually a fascinating paradox, the source notes. The use of backup can create special hazards to responding officers.
Wait, backup can create hazards?
It sounds odd, right? But it's not saying backup isn't crucial. It is. But it highlights challenges like potential friendly fire incidents or just general confusion when multiple units arrive in a high-stress, rapidly evolving situation. Coordination is key. So, officers are trained to be acutely alert for any individuals or vehicles matching those pre-call descriptions, speeding vehicles, specific license plates, or people running or acting unusually nervous or walking fast. It's about piecing together any available information, no matter how small, to manage a chaotic situation and prioritize safety above all else.
That's incredibly insightful into those immediate challenges officers face.
Right.
So, okay, an officer is on scene. They've made those initial tactical assessments. What's the very first priority they establish to ensure everything else can proceed effectively? What's the bedrock principle here?
Okay, once an officer is on scene, the absolute first priority, the foundation for everything that follows, is the protection and security of a scene. This is actually the first of what the sources identify as the five stages for the preliminary investigation.
Stages, okay.
Yeah, these stages represent a systematic, methodical approach to effective crime scene management. It's about ensuring that justice can actually be served based on untainted evidence. It's really about creating order out of potential chaos, ensuring that valuable clues aren't lost or contaminated right at the start.
Okay, so stage one is protection and security. And the motto is safety first, people, then evidence. That's a powerful two-part objective. Can you walk us through the nuances of securing a scene? It sounds like there's a lot more to it than just, you know, putting up yellow tape.
Oh, definitely. The primary objective is indeed safety first, people, then evidence. First things first, ensure the immediate safety of victims, witnesses, other first responders, anyone on scene. Once that immediate human safety is addressed, they immediately turn their attention to preserving evidence. A crucial initial step is that cautious approach we mentioned and determining whether a protective sweep is needed. And importantly, whether it's legally justified, which is something we'll definitely get into later.
A protective sweep, like looking for other people.
Exactly, looking for potential threats. But they also must be hyper aware of evidence to prevent its destruction, like, you know, inadvertently stepping in blood or noticing hazardous conditions that could harm personnel. If medical attention is needed, officers provide or request first aid, but only when it's safe to do so. And critically, if possible, they try to photograph the scene before medical personnel arrive. Because medical interventions, while obviously life-saving, can inevitably alter the scene and potentially destroy valuable evidence.
That makes perfect sense. Protect the people, but try to document before things get moved around. Once the immediate safety and medical needs are addressed, how do they physically secure the perimeter? Because preserving evidence seems like a huge challenge in a dynamic situation.
Yeah, it is. And this is where the formal containment comes in. Officers establish defined entry and exit points, one way in, one way out, ideally. And they create inner and outer perimeters. They use whatever resources are available, street barricades, ropes, crime scene tape, sometimes just additional personnel standing guard, to keep unauthorized individuals out. The goal is explicit in the materials to minimize loss, destruction, and contamination of evidence. Keeping unnecessary people out is paramount.
So it's not just keeping people out, but tracking who does come in.
Precisely. This is where the chain of custody officially begins. It's initiated by meticulously maintained crime scene access logs. Every single person entering or leaving that secured area is documented. Think of it like drawing a series of invisible lines, each one a legal and practical boundary, ensuring the integrity of the scene is maintained from the moment they arrive.
So it's not just about keeping people out. It's about documenting everyone who comes in or out. What's the legal backing for this level of control over a scene? What gives officers the authority to, you know, tell people they can't enter?
The legal authority for crime scene protection is pretty robust, actually. It draws from various state laws. For instance, the Code of Criminal Procedure, or CCP, outlines peace officer duties regarding preventing injury and ensuring proper conduct at a scene. There are also specific sections of the penal code that directly address interfering with this process, things like offenses related to tampering with or fabricating evidence and interference with public duties. It's serious business.
Okay. And what about situations involving a death?
Right. For suspicious deaths, like a potential homicide, the medical examiner or justice of the peace plays a crucial legally defined role. For example, state law requires immediate reporting of suspicious deaths and specifically stipulates that a body shall not be disturbed or removed from the position in which it is found by any person without authorization. That's to preserve evidence. These legal frameworks really underscore the gravity of crime scene integrity and the officer's power and duty to enforce it.
That's a strong legal framework supporting that first stage. Once the scene is secured, what's the next stage in this preliminary investigation? What happens after the initial containment?
Okay, the next phase is stage two, first responder investigation. This marks a significant shift from purely securing the scene to actively gathering information. The officer's duties here are multifaceted and pretty detailed. They must first establish if a crime was actually committed, and if so, what type and classification it is. You know, misdemeanor, felony, what kind of crime. If a perpetrator is present, they will attempt an arrest, obviously. A critical early step is to secure descriptions of the perpetrator, any vehicle used, their direction of flight, get all that from eyewitnesses, and immediately transmit this information to dispatch for broadcast to other units.
So it's about getting that crucial information out to other officers as quickly as possible, like an APB, right?
Exactly, a B on the lookout or below. That early information can be crucial for apprehending suspects quickly.
And then what about the people at the scene, the victims and witnesses? How do officers manage that vital human element of the investigation?
Yeah, that's huge. They locate and interview victims.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
And witnesses meticulously recording their statements. They need to secure vital identification, information names, dates of birth, addresses, phone numbers, employment info, driver's license or license plate numbers, all necessary data for future contacts. And while protecting the crime scene remains an ongoing duty, they also begin searching for and collecting obvious or likely evidence, things they see right away. This evidence must be marked for identification and protected from any change, loss, damage, or contamination. Maintaining that chain of custody we talked about, from discovery all the way until trial, is paramount to its integrity.
And they're figuring out the how and what as well.
Right. Officers determine how the crime was committed, the extent of any injuries, and the nature and value of property taken, if any. All this data, including crime scene searches and evidence collected, is meticulously recorded in field notes, sketches, maybe photographic summaries, and definitely in required reports. This detailed approach, which the source material draws from texts like Weston and Wells' Criminal Investigation, ensures that nothing is overlooked and the foundation for a successful prosecution is laid right from the start.
It sounds incredibly thorough. Beyond the immediate victims and witnesses, how do they expand their information gathering? It seems like a lot to juggle.
It is. They often conduct neighborhood canvassing, you know, knocking on nearby doors, always checking the exterior of the scene for entry or exit signs and any additional evidence that might be outside the main area. A key technique for interviews is separating witnesses.
Why separate them?
To prevent them from influencing each other's accounts. You want their individual recollections, untainted by what someone else might say. They focus on obtaining the crucial 5 W's and 1 H: who, what, when, where, why, and how. Essentially getting the full story from each person independently. They make necessary arrests or detentions right there on scene if needed. And in cases of serious injury or death, ensure proper identification of victims, always obtaining permission from the medical examiner or justice of the peace before moving a body. That's critical.
Okay. And what about other resources? Do they bring in specialists?
Definitely. They might utilize media reports to solicit information from the wider public or actively work to develop informants sometimes. The sources also briefly mention show-up field IDs, which is where they might bring a witness to view a detained suspect shortly after the crime. But they note these can be controversial if not done correctly, as misidentification can have severe consequences. And finally, yes, they identify special units that may need to be called in for assistance, depending on the nature of the crime.
Like who? What kind of special units?
It could be EMS, obviously. The medical examiner JP for homicides. Maybe the bomb squad, fire department. Military liaisons in some cases, narcotics investigators, other law enforcement agencies, like state or federal, crime scene technicians, supervisors, and of course detectives who will take over the longer term investigation. Each plays a specific role in a larger coordinated response.
So that covers stage one, security, and stage two, the first responder investigation.
Mm-hmm.
But you initially mentioned there were five stages. What about the other three, just briefly?
Ah, excellent point. Wouldn't want to leave those hanging. You're right. So, building on the first two, officers then move into stage three, processing the crime scene. This is where specialized forensic teams, if called in, meticulously document, collect, and preserve every piece of physical evidence. We're talking fingerprints, DNA, ballistics, trace evidence, everything. It's the real deep dive into the physical world of the crime.
Okay, the nitty-gritty science part.
Exactly. Then comes stage four, scene wrap-up. This involves a final, thorough sweep to ensure absolutely nothing's overlooked before the scene is officially released. It often includes debriefing all personnel involved, making sure all perimeters are properly dismantled.
A final check. Makes sense. And the last stage.
And finally, stage five. Conclude and document. This is where all findings, notes, reports, evidence logs, everything are compiled into comprehensive reports. These are shared with other investigative units and ultimately prepared for the legal process, which might include court testimony down the line. These systematic steps are absolutely crucial for the integrity of any investigation, moving from that immediate response to meticulous preparation for potential prosecution and achieving justice.
That makes perfect sense. It sounds like this incredibly complex dance of observation, protection, information gathering, all happening under intense pressure. How do officers make all these critical decisions in real time, considering so many variables without getting completely overwhelmed? Is there a method to the madness?
That's a crucial question, and yes, there is a method. It brings us to something called the Critical Decision-Making Model, or CDM. The sources actually use a Denton PD case study involving a suicidal person as a prime example of this framework in action. The CDM isn't just some theoretical concept. It's a practical, analytical tool officers are trained to use to process information and make the best possible choices during critical incidents. It's designed to bring structure to situations that are often highly chaotic and emotionally charged.
Okay, so it's a structured way to think through a chaotic situation. What are the key questions at the heart of this model? What are they actually asking themselves?
Exactly. It starts even before they arrive on scene. Officers are trained to ask themselves, what do we learn about the subject, the victim, the location from dispatch? Did dispatch provide enough context, or do we need more information right away? Who called 911 and why? Are there weapons involved? Children? Animals on scene? These things can drastically change the risk assessment and the necessary response. What's the history here? Have there been previous calls to this location? Any known mental health issues? Drug use? History of violence? Prior arrests? What are the location dynamics? Think about security, containment possibilities for the scene. Then, critically, officers must do some self-reflection. Are there any assumptions I'm making? Any biases creeping in? Any actions of concern I should be aware of in myself or others?
Self-awareness is built in.
Yes, it's crucial. And then, what further information do I want or need right now? And based on similar situations, what does my training and experience tell me about this kind of scenario?
That's a lot of initial assessment even before setting foot on the scene. And once they're there, does the model continue to guide them? Does it adapt?
Yes, absolutely. It's a constant iterative process. You can think of it like a doctor's diagnostic process, constantly reassessing symptoms, gathering new information, and adapting the treatment plan. The CDM then moves into these analytical steps. Okay, do we have any new information now that changes our understanding of the situation? Are there new threats emerging or new risks we need to deal with? Based on all of this updated information, what are our options now? What can we do? And finally, the crucial step. Of all those available options, what is the best option for this specific moment, given all the variables we know? The Denton PD case study mentioned in the source actually walks through showing different sections of the incident video and then pausing to ask these very questions, analyzing the officer's evolving decision-making in real time.
So it helps them analyze after the fact, too, for training.
Exactly. But in the moment, the goal is to choose the optimal path in a high-stakes, rapidly evolving situation, minimizing risk and maximizing safety for everyone involved, the public, the officers, the subject. It's a framework that allows officers to make reasoned judgments under extreme pressure.
That makes sense. It's a constant feedback loop. But what about the boundaries of their power? When they arrive at a scene, especially if it involves someone's home, someone's private property, where do individual rights begin and end? This is where, the cornerstone of our privacy, the Fourth Amendment, becomes absolutely critical, right?
Precisely. This is where we delve into the core of Fourth Amendment protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, especially as they apply to private property. And you're right, it's fundamental. The legal framework here is quite precise, and it distinguishes between areas with varying levels of privacy expectation. Understanding this is fundamental for protecting individual liberty while allowing police to do their jobs.
So not all land is treated equally under the Fourth Amendment when it comes to police entry. Can you explain the difference between open fields and curtilage? These terms sound very legalistic, maybe a bit confusing for someone new to this.
They do sound formal, but the concepts are actually pretty straightforward once you break them down. Open fields basically refers to areas that officers may enter and search without needing a warrant or even probable cause. Supreme Court cases, like Oliver v. United States, establish that the Fourth Amendment does not protect open fields because they aren't considered part of an individual's house, papers, or effects, the things the amendment specifically protects. Essentially, if you're out in a large open area like a field or woods far from a house, there's generally no reasonable expectation of privacy from police observation.
Okay, so open fields, less privacy. What about curtilage? That sounds like it's much more protected, maybe closer to the home.
Exactly right. Curtilage is the area immediately surrounding a dwelling, and it's considered an extension of the house itself. Therefore, it is protected by the Fourth Amendment. The case United States v. Dunn really clarified this. It provided four factors to help determine what falls into this highly protected zone. First, distance. How close is the area to the home? A front porch, for instance, is undoubtedly curtilage. A barn a quarter mile away? Probably not.
Okay, distance matters. What else?
Second, enclosure by fence. Is the area enclosed? Maybe by a fence. And does that enclosure clearly mark it as part of the home's immediate area? If the home has its own fence and the area in question is outside that fence, it might indicate it's not curtilage. Third, the nature of use. Is the area used for what the courts call intimate home activities? Think backyard family gatherings, a private garden right by the house. The Dunn case specifically noted that a bond used for making drug chemicals was not curtilage because it was positioned away from the house and clearly not used for typical domestic activities.
Right, not exactly a family picnic spot.
Precisely. And fourth, observation protection. Is the area shielded from observation by people who might be in those open fields we talked about? If an area is completely exposed, like maybe a barn in an open field, peering into it might not be protected. But crucially, peering into the windows of a home from the front porch, which is curtilage, is protected unless the officer already has probable cause or another exception applies. This whole framework ensures that the sanctity of the home extends to its immediate private surroundings, but it also defines where that heightened protection ends.
That's a very clear delineation. So if curtilage is protected like the home, are there any situations where officers can enter it without a warrant, like in an emergency?
Yes, definitely. There are specific exigent circumstances, which basically means an urgent situation demanding immediate action. Brigham City, Utah v. Stewart from 2006 is a key case here. In that scenario, officers responded to a loud party call around 3 a.m. They heard shouting from inside, saw juveniles drinking alcohol in the backyard, which is curtilage, and then through a screen door and windows, they actually witnessed a physical altercation, a fight happening inside the kitchen.
Okay, so they saw a fight happening right then.
Exactly. And the key ruling from the Supreme Court was unanimous.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Four seasons greetings to you all from Menards.
Animus. Exigent circumstances, such as breaking up a violent fight, permit warrantless entry into a dwelling without a warrant. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it underscores that the Fourth Amendment, why protective, allows for pragmatic exceptions when there are immediate threats to safety or serious criminal activity clearly visible or audible. The law tries to balance privacy with the need for immediate intervention in true emergencies.
That's a critical distinction. What about protective sweeps? You mentioned those earlier when securing a scene. When can officers conduct those inside a home, and what are their limits? It sounds like something that could potentially be overused if not careful.
That's a valid concern, and the law does set limits. A protective sweep is another important but narrow exception defined by Maryland v. Boo in 1990. The question in that case was basically, when making a lawful arrest inside a home, can police conduct a quick, warrantless search of the premises if they have a reasonable suspicion that other dangerous people might be hiding inside?
Okay, so it's about looking for other potential threats after an arrest.
Yes, primarily for officer safety. The Supreme Court ruled, yes, it is permitted, but only if it's supported by reasonable suspicion justified by articulable facts. This can't just be a hunch. They need concrete reasons to believe someone else dangerous might be present. And there are crucial limitations. The sweep is strictly limited to areas where a person could actually be hiding think closets, maybe behind a door. Under a bed, space is large enough to conceal a person, and it can last no longer than necessary to dispel that suspicion of danger. It's a quick look, not a thorough search.
And can they seize things they find during this sweep?
Yes. The plain view doctrine still applies. If, during the lawful protective sweep, an officer sees contraband or evidence of a crime out in the open, they can seize it. But the sweep itself is a narrow exception designed for officer safety during an arrest, not a license for a general search.
And on a more practical, less legalistic note, what about officers' physical positioning when they're dealing with someone at a door? Seems like there's tactical advice there, too, maybe linked to safety.
Absolutely. The training material is very specific about this. The advice is essentially, do not stand in doorways and stand away from the door.
Why not stand in the doorway? Seems like the most direct spot.
Because most doors, especially interior ones, are hollow and offer basically no cover if someone inside were to pose a threat, like shooting through the door. Instead, officers are advised to stand off to the side. The framing around the door and the exterior walls might provide more substantial cover. There's even more detailed tactics discussed, like considering opposing versus same-side approaches relative to other officers, or whether to position on the knob side or hinge side of a door. These are all small details aimed at maximizing officer safety and tactical advantage in a potentially dangerous encounter right at the threshold.
That all makes sense for safety. Now let's pivot a bit to the legal authority for making arrests without a warrant. We know warrants are generally preferred, but when can police actually make an arrest on the spot? It seems like a major exception to the rule.
It is a major exception, but a necessary one for practical law enforcement. The law recognizes there are situations where officers simply must act immediately. The source material outlines 11 specific scenarios in Texas where officers can make a warrantless arrest when they have probable cause, even while on duty.
11. Wow, that's quite a few. Can you give us the gist of them? Maybe group them?
Yeah, we can group them. They generally fall into a few categories. First, there are situations where an offense is happening right in front of them or very recently connected to their presence. So an arrest is allowed for any offense within view presence of the officer. Pretty straightforward. If they see a crime happen, they can arrest. Also, if a felony or breach of the peace occurs in view of a magistrate, like a judge, and the magistrate verbally orders the arrest, and if there's probable cause of a felony and a real risk, the person will escape if they wait for a warrant.
Okay, so immediate felonies or breaches of peace they see.
Right. Also included here is if someone admits to a felony admission with other probable cause. So a confession plus other evidence. And a really important one, if persons are found in a suspicious place or under circumstances that reasonably show they've committed or are about to commit a felony or breach of peace, and there's a reasonable urgency to arrest, they can. That covers a lot of on-the-spot encounters.
That first category seems pretty clear, mostly about seeing a crime happen or having very strong immediate evidence.
Yeah.
What about situations where public safety or a victim's safety is immediately at risk? Is that another category?
Exactly. That's the second broad category. For instance, officers can arrest without a warrant to prevent the consequences of theft. This is a proactive power to stop stolen property from being concealed or moved right after a theft. More critically, for a non-family violence assault where there's probable cause that the victim is in danger of further bodily injury, an immediate arrest is authorized. This lets officers step in and stop ongoing harm.
And family violence specifically.
Yes, that's a huge one. For any family violence offense, regardless of whether it happened in the officer's presence or not, if probable cause exists based on evidence at the scene, like victim testimony, injuries, an arrest can be made without a warrant. This is a really powerful tool designed to protect victims in domestic situations. And lastly in this group, emergency call interference allows for arrest if there's probable cause that someone stopped another person from calling 911 or for other emergency help.
Okay, victim safety is key there. What's the third category of these warrantless arrest powers?
Right.
What else allows arrest without going to a judge first?
The third category generally involves cases where a court order needs immediate enforcement or specific legally defined circumstances. This includes situations involving protective orders. If an officer has probable cause that a protective order has been violated in their presence, they shall arrest. Notice the word shall. It's a mandatory arrest in that situation, removing officer discretion.
Mandatory arrest for violating protective orders. Got it.
And the 11th power listed is for an out-of-state fugitive. If someone is charged in another state with a serious crime, one punishable by death or at least 1 year in prison under the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act, a Texas officer can make a warrantless arrest based on probable cause they are that fugitive. So these 11 scenarios provide those critical legal pathways for officers to act swiftly without needing to secure a warrant first. It's always about balancing the legal process with practical necessity and immediate safety concerns.
That's a comprehensive list. But let's go back to the home. What about entering someone's home to make one of these warrantless arrests? The home is especially protected, right? It seems like a fundamental privacy right we all have.
You are absolutely right. The home has the highest level of Fourth Amendment protection. This is a highly nuanced and legally complex area. The landmark case here is Peyton v. New York from 1980. The Supreme Court ruled quite clearly, no, police generally cannot enter a suspect's home without an arrest warrant specifically for that person and location to make a routine felony arrest.
So even if they have probable cause for the felony arrest, they can't just go in.
Correct. That prohibition exists unless there are exigent circumstances, those emergency situations we talked about, or another recognized exception to the warrant rule. The core principle is that the Fourth Amendment's shield against unreasonable searches and seizures extends firmly to the privacy of the home itself. Probable cause for arrest alone typically isn't enough to cross that threshold without a warrant or consent or exigency.
So an arrest warrant for a person isn't automatically a key to their house. What does the Texas Code of Criminal Procedure say about this? Does state law reinforce that privacy?
It does. State law, specifically CCP 14.05, mirrors this principle. It says that even when making a legal warrantless arrest, using one of those 11 powers we listed, officers may use the legal measures allowed for warrant arrests, except, and this is the key part, they may not enter a residence to make that arrest unless one of two conditions is met. Either a resident consents to the entry or exigent circumstances require that the officer making the arrest enter the residence without the consent of a resident or without a warrant. This means even if you have solid probable cause for a warrantless arrest, getting into a home without a search warrant for that specific address or explicit consent to enter for the purpose of arrest requires a very high bar of immediate need or danger.
This brings up an interesting debate then. What if the suspect is standing right in an open doorway? Does that count as being in a public place, or is it still part of the protected home? It feels like a really fine line.
It is a fine line, and it's known as the open door debate. It's a fascinating and actually still somewhat unsettled area of law. A key case is United States v. Santana from 1976. The Supreme Court ruled that a suspect may not defeat a warrantless arrest that began in a public place by retreating to a private place. The crucial interpretation from Santana by many courts is that standing in an open doorway is considered being in a public place. Why? Because you have no reasonable expectation of privacy when you're visible and exposed to public view and conversation right there at the threshold.
So if you open the door to the police, some courts say you're essentially in public.
That's how many courts interpret Santana, yes. They argue that by opening the door and standing there, you reduce your expectation of privacy, making you subject to a warrantless arrest from the threshold without the officers actually stepping inside.
But we see this as a debate. So not all courts agree on this interpretation of an open doorway. What's the other side?
That's right. Some courts, like the U.S. Second Circuit, for instance, have argued that Peyton v. New York's protection of the home prohibits non-consensual entries for routine arrests, and that ordering someone out from their doorway under threat of arrest is effectively a non-consensual entry, even if the officer doesn't physically cross the threshold. They focus more on whether the police used coercive behavior from outside to compel the person to come out. For example, multiple officers with guns drawn ordering a suspect out, some courts might see that as a patent violation even without physical entry.
So it's about physical intrusion versus coercive action from outside.
Exactly. That's the core of the debate. Does patent only bar physical intrusion, or does it also bar police from using coercive tactics from the doorway that effectively force someone out of their home? The Supreme Court has, to date, chosen not to take a case and rule directly on this specific open door coercion debate, leaving it an area where different circuit courts have different opinions. It's a really good example of how legal interpretation can vary on these fine points.
And once an arrest is lawfully made inside a home, what are the limits on searching the surrounding area? Can officers just start searching everything within reach once they have the person in cuffs?
Okay. That brings us to searches incident to arrest inside a home, which is governed by another landmark case, Chimmel v. California, decided way back in 1964. The Supreme Court ruled that a warrantless search conducted incident to a lawful arrest inside a home can only cover the area in possession or control of the person being arrested. This is often referred to as the arrestee's wingspan or grab area.
The grab area, meaning what they could physically reach.
Precisely. The rationale is twofold. Officer safety, ensuring the arrestee can't grab a weapon and preventing the destruction of evidence that might be within their immediate reach. But Chimmel explicitly does not allow for searching the entire house just because an arrest was made inside. It's strictly limited to that immediate area around the person at the moment of arrest.
That seems logical for officer safety and evidence. But you mentioned Gunn v. Arizona earlier in relation to Chimmel. How does Gunn, which dealt with vehicle searches, potentially impact home searches incident to arrest?
That's where things get interesting and show how law evolves. The implications of Gunn v. Arizona from 2009 are significant. Gunn significantly limited vehicle searches incident to arrest. It basically says such searches are only permissible if the arrestee is unsecured and actually within reaching distance of the passenger compartment at the time of the search, or if it's reasonable to believe the vehicle contains evidence of the specific crime they were arrested for.
Okay, so Gunn restricted vehicle searches incident to arrest. How does that affect Chimmel and home searches?
Well, it raises questions about Chimmel's continued broad application for home arrests. If Gunn requires a higher justification for searching a car incident to arrest, either immediate access by the unsecured arrestee or specific evidence of the crime, why would Chimmel still allow a potentially broader search of the grab area in a home incident to arrest, especially if the person is already secured, for example, handcuffed? It seems a bit illogical, right, that a potentially less restrictive search standard applies inside a highly protected home compared to a less protected vehicle, particularly after Gunn.
Yeah, that does seem inconsistent.
It does. Chimmel is from 1964, and Gunn is much more recent, 2009. This has led to ongoing legal discussion and speculation about whether Chimmel's scope might eventually be further limited by the courts to align more closely with the stricter Gantt standard, especially regarding secured arrestees. It showcases how legal interpretations adapt over time based on new rulings and societal values.
It's clear that the home is a specially protected space under the Fourth Amendment, and warrants are generally the preferred way to enter or search. So if a warrant is usually needed, what are the major ways police can still operate without one? Particularly when it involves someone essentially giving up their rights.
This brings us to a really important exception, consent searches. These are a powerful tool for law enforcement because they represent a waiver of constitutional protection by the individual. If you consent, you're essentially saying the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to this specific search. However, because it involves waiving a fundamental right, this power comes with very strict rules to ensure the waiver is truly legitimate and not the result of pressure or misunderstanding.
What are the foundational requirements for consent to be valid? Is it just a simple yes, enough, or does it need more?
It needs more than just a yes. The waiver must be voluntary and knowingly given. That's paramount. It can't be forced. The person giving consent also remains in control. This is crucial. They have the right to limit the scope of the search, saying you can look here, but not there. Or they can revoke their consent entirely at any point during the search. If they say stop, the search must stop unless officers have developed another legal basis by then, like probable cause.
They can change their mind midway through.
Absolutely. And consent is immediately deemed involuntary if obtained by duress, coercion, or acquiescence to authority. This means officers can't strong-arm someone, threaten them, or imply they have no choice but to consent. It has to be a free choice. A practical tip mentioned in the training materials for officers is that consent can sometimes be difficult to prove later in court. Did the person really consent voluntarily? So officers are often advised to get it in writing or at least on a recording if possible. This protects both the officer by providing proof and the individual's rights by ensuring clarity.
And what about the scope of a consent search? If someone consents to a search of their car, for example, does that automatically mean officers can open every closed container inside? Or even, say, pry open a locked box they find?
That's a great question, and it's addressed by Florida v. Jimeno from 1991. The Supreme Court ruled that officers can open closed containers within a vehicle if it's objectively reasonable to believe the scope of the suspect's consent permits the officer to do so.
Objectively reasonable? What does that mean in practice?
It uses the reasonable person standard. If an officer clearly states the purpose of the search, for example, I'm looking for illegal drugs, a reasonable person hearing that would likely understand that drugs are often hidden inside containers. So general consent to search the car for drugs would usually allow the officer to look inside unlocked containers where drugs might reasonably be found. However, context matters. Prying open a locked briefcase found in the car without specific, explicit permission might be considered unreasonable. A general consent to search the car usually doesn't imply consent to break open locked items. It's about what a typical reasonable person would understand their yes to mean, given the conversation they had with the officer.
That makes sense. It depends on what they asked to search for. But who even can give consent to search? Can anyone just give permission for police to search someone else's property? Like, can I neighbor consent to a search of my house?
No, absolutely not. That's a key point. Only a person with what the law calls a possessory or proprietary interest in the area or property being searched may give valid consent. Basically, you need to have some authority or control over the place. This leads to the complexities of third-party consent when someone tries to give consent to search a place or thing belonging to someone else. Illinois v. Rodriguez, 1990, is important here. It established that a warrantless entry and search based on third-party consent is valid if the police reasonably believe, at the time of the search, that the consenting person has the authority to consent, even if they later learn that person didn't actually have it.
So it's based on the officer's reasonable belief at that moment.
Exactly. The focus is on the officer's reasonable perception of the situation at the time they obtained consent, not on whether the person actually had legal authority in hindsight. It means officers don't have to be perfect legal scholars on property law in the moment, just reasonable in their assessment based on the apparent circumstances.
Okay. So, applying that, what about a landlord? Can a landlord let police search their tenant's apartment, even though they own the building? That seems like something people might get wrong.
You're right. It's a common misconception. But the answer is clear. Landlords may not consent to a law enforcement search of a rented dwelling or room. While landlords might have the right to enter for specific reasons outlined in a lease agreement, like maintenance or emergencies, that right does not extend to authorizing a police search for criminal investigation purposes. The tenant has the primary possessory interest and expectation of privacy in their rented space.
So your home is your castle, even if you rent it.
Exactly. The same principle applies to hotel or motel clerks regarding a guest's room. They can't consent to a police search of an occupied room.
What about parent-child situations? Can parents consent to search their kids' rooms? Does the child's age matter?
It generally does depend on the age and circumstances. For minor children, parents, quote, may usually consent to the search of a minor child's room. This is based on the parent's authority over the household and responsibility for the minor. However, the source material suggests that for an older child, say a 17-year-old, who might have a greater expectation of privacy in their own room, the situation gets murkier. It might be that the child themselves must consent before law enforcement can search, especially if the child is paying rent or has clearly established exclusive control over that space.
So it's not automatic for older teens?
It seems less automatic, yes. But interestingly, parents can generally search their child's room on their own without law enforcement involvement. This is usually considered private action, not governmental action. And this brings up that important concept of governmental action versus private searches. The Fourth Amendment generally only applies to actions taken by the government or its agents, like police. It's usually inapplicable to purely private, non-governmental action.
Meaning if a private person finds evidence illegally, police can still use it.
Generally, yes. If a private individual, like a parent checking their kid's room for their own reasons, or maybe a landlord doing a routine inspection allowed by the lease, finds evidence of a crime, evidence that would violate the Fourth Amendment, if the police had searched for it that way, and then they voluntarily turn that evidence over to the police, the government may often use it. Why? Because the police didn't violate the Fourth Amendment in obtaining it. The private citizen did, though the citizen isn't bound by the Fourth Amendment. The key factor courts look at is the degree of governmental participation, encouragement, knowledge, or acquiescence in the private search. If the police didn't instigate or participate in the private search, the evidence is usually fair game.
That's a crucial distinction about private versus governmental action. What about spouses? Can one spouse consent to search the entire home, potentially against the other spouse's wishes?
Good question. Common situation. Generally, yes. Each spouse may generally consent to a search of the entire premises. This stems from the idea that both spouses typically have shared authority and access throughout the home. However, there's a very important limitation established by Georgia v. Randolph in 2006. The ruling was clear. If both spouses are physically present at the scene, and one says no and one says yes to a police request to search, the answer is no. The objecting party's physical presence and clear objection controls. No means no, even if the other spouse agrees.
Okay, so if both are there and one objects, police can't search based on consent. What if the objecting spouse isn't there?
That's where Fernandez v. California 2014 comes in. The court clarified the Randolph rule. It held that if the no spouse is arrested or otherwise no longer present, meaning they've been lawfully removed from the scene or simply absent for some other reason, then the consent of the remaining occupant is effective. So if the objecting spouse has been lawfully arrested and taken away, or just isn't home at the time, the other spouse's consent to search the shared areas can be valid. Presence matters.
And what about roommates? Do the same rules apply as for spouses, since they share common areas but have private rooms?
Yes, the principles are very similar for roommates. A roommate may consent to search their own private room and also the common areas they share with other roommates, like a living room or kitchen. And any yes-no disagreements among roommates regarding a search of those common areas would work the same way as for spouses under Randolph. If one roommate is present and objects to the search of a shared common area, the police cannot search that area based on another roommate's consent. Again, it comes down to who has common authority over this specific area being searched and who is physically present to object.
This is a lot of detail, but it's absolutely critical for understanding how consent works in different living situations. What about searches in schools or workplaces? Do those have entirely different standards because they aren't homes?
They absolutely do have different standards, reflecting their unique environments and purposes. For public schools, the landmark case is New Jersey VTLO from 1985. It established that school officials, like a principal or teacher, can search students or their belongings based on a standard of reasonable suspicion, which is a lower standard than the probable cause required for law enforcement searches.
Why the lower standard for school officials?
The reasoning is that schools have a substantial need to maintain order, safety, and a proper learning environment, requiring them to get warrants or meet the probable cause standard for routine disciplinary issues or safety concerns would unduly interfere with that mission. However, there's a very important caveat mentioned in the Texas source material. In Texas, school officers do not enjoy the same lesser standard.
So school resource officers, SROs, in Texas need probable cause.
Correct. If a school resource officer, who is a commissioned peace officer, is acting in their law enforcement capacity, not just assisting school discipline, they are generally bound by the same Fourth Amendment standards as any other police officer, requiring probable cause for a search, not just reasonable suspicion. It depends on the role they are acting in.
Okay, that's a key state-specific difference. What about workplace searches? Can my boss just search my desk?
It depends on whether you work for a private company or the government. Private employers are generally not subject to the Fourth Amendment because their actions aren't considered governmental action. So your private employer might be able to search your desk based on company policy, though inappropriate searches could potentially lead to civil lawsuits. Government employers, however, are bound by the Fourth Amendment. Their employees don't lose all their privacy rights at the office door. Government workplace searches must be reasonable.
Reasonable? How is that determined?
It involves a reasonableness test laid out in O'Connor v. Ortega, 1987. First, does the employee have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the area searched, like a locked desk or personal locker? Factors include whether the space was for exclusive use, if others had access, and what workplace policies say about searches. If a reasonable expectation of privacy exists, then the search by the government employer must generally be for a legitimate work-related purpose, like investigating misconduct, not just general criminal investigation, and must be reasonable in its duration, manner, and location. Generally, no warrant is needed for these work-related administrative searches if they meet this reasonableness standard.
That's a huge amount of detail on who can give consent and when. It's clearly a complex area. But what about the more formal process, obtaining and executing actual arrest warrants? It sounds like there are very specific requirements for those to be legally sound and to ensure judicial oversight.
You're absolutely right. While we've spent a lot of time on the exceptions like warrantless arrests and consent, the warrant of arrest is the formal, constitutionally preferred path, especially for entering homes. And yes, it has precise definitions and requirements outlined in the Code of Criminal Procedure to ensure it's done correctly.
So what exactly is an arrest warrant, legally speaking?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what absolutely must it contain to be valid? It can't just be a scribbled note, I assume.
Definitely not. According to Texas state law, CCP 15.01, a warrant of arrest is defined as a written order from a magistrate directed to a peace officer, commanding him to take the body of the person accused of an offense to be dealt with according to law. It's essentially a judicial command to arrest someone. Its specific requirements or requisites, CCP 15.02, are crucial for its legal validity. It must be issued in the name of the state of Texas. It must specify the name of the person to be arrested, or if the name is unknown, give a reasonably definite description of them. It must state the offense the person is accused of committing. And very importantly, it must be signed by the magistrate with their office officially named, e.g., Judge, County Court at Law Number 1. These elements ensure it's not a general vague order, but a targeted legal document based on probable cause reviewed by a neutral party.
And what role does the magistrate, the judge, play in issuing these? They're clearly more than just a rubber stamp for the police request.
Absolutely. The magistrate's role is foundational to the whole warrant process. They act as that neutral and detached check on law enforcement power, reviewing the information presented to ensure there is sufficient probable cause before authorizing an arrest. According to CCP 15.03, they can issue warrants or summons in basically three ways. When the law specifically authorizes their verbal order of arrest, which is rare. When the Code of Criminal Procedure allows it in specific circumstances, or most commonly based on a sworn oath or affidavit presented to them by someone, usually a police officer or prosecutor, laying out the facts that establish probable cause that an offense has been committed by the named person. This ensures an independent review of the evidence before someone's liberty is potentially taken away.
You mentioned the summons there as well. How does that differ from a warrant? Is it like a less severe version of being ordered to court?
That's a good way to think of it, yes. A summons, also covered in CCP 15.03, can often be issued in any case where a warrant could be issued, particularly for less serious offenses. But instead of commanding an immediate arrest, it summons the defendant. It orders them to appear before a magistrate at a stated time and place. It can be served personally, left at the defendant's residence with a suitable person, or sometimes mailed. If the defendant then fails to appear in response to the summons, then a warrant for their arrest will typically be issued. So it provides an alternative to immediate arrest, allowing the individual the chance to come to court voluntarily first.
How far does an arrest warrant actually extend? Is it only valid in the city or county where it was issued, or can an officer use it anywhere in the state?
That generally depends on who issued it. According to CCP 15.06, a warrant issued by any county or district clerk, or by most magistrates, like district judges, county judges, JPs, extends to every part of the state. Any peace officer in Texas can execute that warrant anywhere within the state boundaries. It's a truly statewide document in those cases.
So most warrants are statewide. Are there exceptions?
Yes. The main exception involves warrants issued by city or town mayors who can sometimes act as magistrates. According to CCP 15.07, mayor's warrants generally have a more limited geographic scope. They are usually only valid within the county where their city or town is located, unless one of two things happens. Either the mayor's warrant is endorsed by a judge of a court of record, which makes it valid statewide, or it's endorsed by any magistrate in the county where the accused person is actually found, which makes it valid in that specific county. So, mayor's warrants need an extra step to be effective outside their home county.
It seems like there's another legal term that sounds really similar to an arrest warrant. Capias. What's the difference between a warrant and a capias? Because that sounds like it could be confusing for people.
That's an excellent question, as they are indeed often confused, but they serve different purposes. A capias, defined in CCP 23.01, is a distinct type of writ or court order. While an arrest warrant is typically issued before formal charges are filed, or right at the beginning, to initiate the arrest process for someone accused of a crime, a capias is usually issued by a judge or court clerk after a person has already been formally charged, like by indictment, or after they've been released on bail, but before their trial is over.
So it's used later in the process.
Exactly. It's a writ commanding an officer to arrest a person who is already accused within the court system and bring them immediately back to that specific court, or hold them until a specific return date. Essentially, it's often used when someone fails to appear in court as required, or violates their bail conditions. It's about bringing someone back into the ongoing judicial process rather than initiating it like a typical arrest warrant does. The requirements for a capias, CCP 23.02, are similar to an arrest warrant, naming the person, the offense, the specific court it's returnable to, date, official attestation, but its context is post-charge or post-bail.
Okay, that clarifies the difference. Now, when an officer is actually executing a valid arrest warrant, what level of force is allowed, and what are they required to tell the person they're arresting?
State law addresses both of those. Regarding force, CCP 15.24 states that in making an arrest, all reasonable means are permitted to effect it. However, there's a crucial limitation. No greater force than is necessary shall be used to secure the arrest and detention of the accused. It's a reasonableness standard based on the circumstances. As for notification, CCP 15.26 requires that the authority of arrest must be made known. Interestingly, officers don't necessarily need to have the warrant physically in their possession at the exact moment of arrest.
They don't need the paperwork.
Not necessarily right at that second, but they must inform the defendant of the offense they are being charged with and the fact that a warrant has been issued. And if the defendant requests to see the warrant, the officer shall show it to them as soon as possible afterwards. Furthermore, for transparency, once a warrant is executed, meaning the arrest is made, both the warrant itself and any supporting affidavit used to get it become public information. The magistrate's clerk is required to make copies available for public inspection.
This brings us back to that crucial Fourth Amendment protection of the home. We talked about Peyton saying you generally need a warrant to enter a suspect's own home for an arrest. What if an officer has an arrest warrant for someone, but they think that person is hiding inside a third party's home, like a friend's house or relative's house? Can they use the arrest warrant to just go into that friend's house?
This is a critical limitation, and the answer comes from Stiegold v. United States, 1981. The core principle established here is no. Absent consent from the homeowner or exigent circumstances, the Fourth Amendment prohibits police from searching for the subject of an arrest warrant inside a third party's home without first obtaining a search warrant specifically for that third party's residence.
So they need a search warrant, not just the arrest warrant. Why the difference?
Because an arrest warrant only addresses the Fourth Amendment rights of the person named in the warrant, it authorizes seizing that person. It does not address the separate Fourth Amendment privacy rights of the innocent third party whose home is being entered. Searching a third party's home based solely on someone else's arrest warrant is considered unreasonable without a separate search warrant that establishes probable cause to believe the suspect is currently located at that specific third party address. It's a critical protection for innocent homeowners or residents who aren't the target of the arrest warrant.
And finally, what about the May break door rule we touched on briefly? Does that apply only to arrest warrants, and what are its limits, especially considering Stiegold? It sounds pretty dramatic.
The May break door rule, found in CCP 15.25, sounds dramatic, and it is a significant power. It states that in case of felony, the officer may break down the door of any house for the purpose of making an arrest, but only if they are first refused admittance after giving notice of his authority and purpose.
So knock and announce first, then force entry if refused, but only for felonies.
Yes, that's the basic rule. However, and this is crucial, it ties directly back to Peyton and Stiegold. For this rule to apply when executing an arrest warrant, the person being arrested must generally reside there for the officer to legally break down the door after being refused entry, unless, of course, an exigency, like shots fired from inside or imminent destruction of evidence or another exception, allows the entry into that specific location, regardless of who lives there. So while the rule exists, you can't just use an arrest warrant to break down a random third party's door just because you think your suspect might be inside and they didn't answer. The warrant generally only justifies forced entry into the suspect's own residence after refusal or if exigent circumstances exist at that location.
This is a lot to process, especially with all the nuances and legal precedents swirling around entry, search, and arrest. I can see the logic, especially given the potential chaos of a scene, but practically, it must be incredibly difficult for officers to keep all those distinct rules and factors straight in the heat of the moment. Let's try to make this really real for our listener and apply these principles to some practical situations.
Excellent idea. It's precisely why training is so rigorous and ongoing, because real-life situations rarely fit neatly into textbook examples. Let's walk through several scenarios drawn from the source material. For each one, we'll state the relevant facts, identify the applicable legal principles we've just discussed, things like reasonable suspicion, probable cause, specific warrantless powers, Fourth Amendment exceptions like plain view or consent rules, and then explain the correct police action and, importantly, why it's justified legally. This should help solidify these concepts, especially for anyone new to them.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start with scenario one, apartment parking lot, suspicious person. Here are the facts. It's 3 a.m., cold and windy. An officer on patrol sees a person looking into multiple cars in an apartment complex parking lot. The officer watches as the person tries a car door, finds it locked, then leans against the car holding some kind of metal object. When the officer approaches and contacts this person, they notice the person is wearing rubber gloves and is holding a Slim Jim tool. The person claims they were just seeking shelter from the wind, but refuses to explain the tool, saying none of your business. They also state they don't own the car they were leaning against. What's going on here, legally speaking? What can the officer do?
Okay, lots of factors here. Initially, the officer definitely has reasonable suspicion to detain the individual from the moment they observe them trying car doors at 3 a.m. in a parking lot that's highly suspicious behavior, regardless of the weather. The cold and wind don't negate the suspicious actions. The observation of the metal object, later confirmed to be a Slim Jim, a common burglary tool, combined with the rubber gloves, often used to avoid leaving fingerprints, significantly escalates that suspicion. When the person refuses to explain the tool and admits they don't own the car, that elevates the situation from reasonable suspicion to probable cause for an arrest.
Probable cause for what crime?
Well, possible offenses include attempted burglary of a vehicle, likely a felony if entry was attempted, or at least misdemeanor criminal mischief, and also possession of criminal instruments having tools specifically designed or adapted for committing a crime. So the officer's progression would be observe suspicious activity, basis for temporary detention investigation, gather more facts, gloves, Slim Jim, no ownership, refusal to explain tool, which builds to probable cause for arrest. The officer would detain immediately based on reasonable suspicion, then move to arrest once the elements of probable cause are clearly established.
Okay, that makes sense. Next, scenario two. Stolen Porsche, suspect in residence. An officer sees a man park a brand new Porsche at a private residence and quickly go inside. About 5 minutes later, dispatch puts out a broadcast. That specific Porsche was just stolen from a dealership nearby, a felony, and the man seen driving it matches the suspect description. The officer goes to the house, confirms the VIN shows the car is stolen. The officer knocks on the door. The sister of the suspect answers. She owns the house. She refuses to give the officer consent to enter. However, the officer can see the suspect sitting on the couch inside, behind her. Can the officers enter the sister's house to arrest the brother in this situation?
This is a classic scenario hitting on the Peyton rule about home entry and the Stiegeld rule about third-party residences. It's tricky. First, the officers clearly have probable cause to arrest the brother for felony auto theft. No question there. However, they are at a third party's home. The sister owns the residence, not the suspect. And the sister has explicitly refused consent to enter. So, based purely on Stiegeld v. United States, having an arrest warrant for the brother, even if they had one, which they don't seem to yet, but even if they did, would not automatically allow entry into the sister's home without her consent or a separate search warrant for her residence.
So even seeing him on the couch isn't enough.
Generally, just seeing him isn't enough to overcome the sister's refusal and the Stiegeld protection for her home. However, the analysis doesn't stop there. We have to consider exigent circumstances. Is there an immediate risk of the suspect escaping? Could he destroy evidence, like maybe keys or documents related to the theft, now that he knows police are at the door? Is there a risk of violence? If the officer reasonably believes, based on the circumstances, that immediate entry is necessary to prevent escape, destruction of evidence, or harm, that exigency could potentially justify a warrantless entry into the sister's home. It's a high bar, though.
So if there's no clear emergency or risk of escape.
If there's no clear exigency, the officer's best course of action would likely be to secure the perimeter of the house to prevent the suspect from fleeing and then immediately apply for a search warrant for the sister's residence, authorizing them to enter and arrest the brother. They have the probable cause for the warrant. They just need the judicial authorization to enter the third-party home. The open door debate isn't really applicable here since the sister is blocking the way and refusing entry.
Okay, got it. Scenario 3. Bar fight. Intoxicated combatants. Officers are dispatched to a fight at a bar. When they arrive, the fight has just been broken up by bar staff. Two men involved, Mike and Jeff, are identified. Both are clearly intoxicated. Mike is still agitated, yelling, "This ain't over," and being verbally abusive toward Jeff and the officers. Jeff, on the other hand, is calm, though also intoxicated. Neither the bar staff nor Jeff want to press any assault charges. Both Mike and Jeff have sober friends present who are willing to take them home. What can or should the officer do here? Can they arrest anyone?
This scenario brings up officer discretion versus mandatory action and the offense within view presence warrantless arrest power. Even though no one wants to press assault charges from the fight itself, Mike is currently committing an offense in the officer's presence. His yelling, abusive language, and threats, this ain't over, likely constitute a breach of the public peace or disorderly conduct under state law. His intoxication contributes to this. Because Mike is actively committing this offense right in front of them, the officers have the legal authority to make a warrantless arrest for that breach of peace or disorderly conduct.
Even if his friends can take him home?
Yes, the legal authority exists. However, this is where officer discretion often comes in for minor offenses like this. Since sober friends are willing to take him home and the initial fight victims don't want charges, the officer might choose to simply ensure he leaves with his friends and doesn't cause further disturbance, perhaps issuing a warning. But they could legally arrest him based on his ongoing behavior. For Jeff, since he is calm and not currently committing any observable offense, other than perhaps public intoxication, which again might be handled by release to friends, an arrest would likely not be justified or necessary. The focus would be on Mike's active disruption.
Scenario 4. Cocaine through curtains, plain view. A plainclothes officer is conducting surveillance in an area known for drug activity. From a public sidewalk, the officer observes through slightly open curtains into an apartment window. Inside, the officer clearly sees two subjects weighing and separating a white powdery substance that the officer, based on training and experience, believes to be cocaine. What can or should the officers do? Can they just go in?
This is a classic plain view doctrine scenario, but with a crucial step needed. First, the officer is in a place where they have a legal right to be the public sidewalk. Second, they're observing apparent criminal activity through an unobstructed view into a space. Now, peering into windows from a public space can be tricky, but if the curtains are open enough to allow a clear view without special equipment, it often qualifies. Third, the nature of the substance as contraband, cocaine, is immediately apparent to the officer based on their training and the context. Weighing, separating. This plain view observation gives the officers clear, probable cause to believe a felony drug offense is occurring inside.
So does probable cause let them enter immediately?
No, not automatically. Remember, Peyton and the protection of the home. Plain view of contraband inside a home generally does not by itself create an exigent circumstance allowing warrantless entry. So the officers cannot simply barge in based on the plain view alone. What they should do is, one, secure the location from the outside to prevent suspects from fleeing or destroying the evidence. They might detain anyone trying to leave. Two, immediately seek a search warrant for the apartment based on the probable cause established through the plain view observation. They have strong grounds for a warrant. The only way they could potentially enter without a warrant is if new exigent circumstances arise, like if they suddenly hear sounds indicating the evidence is being destroyed, toilets flushing repeatedly, etc., or violence breaks out inside. But the initial plain view itself requires getting a warrant before entry.
Okay, that warrant step is key. Let's skip scenario 5 and go to scenario 6. Neighbor dispute with children present. Required actions. Officers respond to a disturbance call involving ongoing arguments between two neighboring families, the Smiths and the Walkers. There have been issues with loud parties at the Smiths' house. A third neighbor actually called police this time about the arguing. When officers talk to the Walkers, they express frustration about the noise, but also reward. They often see small children, apparently unsupervised, wandering around the Smiths' yard during these loud parties, sometimes late at night, while the adults present seem intoxicated. What can officers do here? And perhaps more importantly, what are they required to do?
Okay, two distinct issues here. First, the immediate disturbance. Officers can certainly address the breach of the peace related to the loud argument they might be witnessing or that was reported. They can attempt to mediate, issue warnings for disorderly conduct or noise violations, or potentially make arrests if the conduct persists or escalates in their presence. However, the second part, the Walkers report about potentially unsupervised children with intoxicated adults, triggers a much more serious concern and potential legal requirement.
What requirement is that?
This information raises red flags about potential child endangerment or neglect. In Texas, peace officers are mandatory reporters of suspected child abuse or neglect. So officers are required to investigate this allegation further. They need to try and assess the situation at the Smith's house regarding the children's safety. If their investigation gives them probable cause to believe that the children are being neglected or are in immediate danger due to the environment, for example, unsupervised near drunk adults, unsafe conditions, they have a mandatory duty to report their suspicions to Child Protective Services, CPS, or the appropriate state agency.
Could they enter the Smith's house based on this report?
Possibly, but carefully. They can certainly knock and try to speak with the Smiths and observe the conditions. If they are refused entry but have strong, specific reasons to believe a child is in imminent danger inside, they might be able to justify a warrantless entry under exigent circumstances to protect life or prevent serious injury, or possibly the community caretaking function. However, this would require more than just the neighbor's general report. It would likely need observations confirming immediate danger. But the reporting requirement to CPS based on credible suspicion is key. They can't just ignore that part of the call.
Got it. Mandatory reporting is key there. Scenario 7. Family violence. Suspect gone to bar. Officers respond to an active family violence call. When they arrive, the suspect is gone. The victim is present and has visible injuries, for she bruises, maybe a cut lip. She tells the officers her boyfriend, who lives with her, physically assaulted her shortly before they arrived. She knows he went to a specific local bar nearby. Can the officers go to that bar and arrest the boyfriend based on the victim's statement and injuries, even though they didn't see the assault?
Yes, absolutely. This falls squarely under one of those specific police warrantless arrest powers we discussed earlier. The power to arrest for any family violence offense based on probable cause. Even though the assault did not occur in the officer's presence, the visible injuries on the victim, combined with her credible statement identifying her boyfriend, who resides with her as the assailant, provides strong probable cause to believe a family violence assault occurred. The law specifically allows officers to make a warrantless arrest for family violence if they have probable cause, regardless of whether they witnessed it. This is a critical tool designed to address the often hidden nature of domestic violence and protect victims even when officers arrive after the abuser has left. So yes, they can definitely go to the bar, locate the boyfriend, and arrest him based on the probable cause developed at the scene with the victim.
Okay, clear authority there for family violence. Scenario 8, open carry handgun at coffee shop. Customer alarmed. An officer is dispatched to a local coffee shop. The call is from a customer who reports seeing another subject inside, sitting and reading a newspaper, who has a handgun visibly holstered on his belt. The reporting customer says they are alarmed by the presence of the gun. What can and should the officer do in this situation, considering that open carry might be perfectly legal?
This scenario really highlights the tricky balance between lawful activity under the Second Amendment and public perception or fear. In Texas, licensed open carry of a handgun in a holster is generally legal in many public places, including likely a coffee shop, unless specific signage prohibits it. Therefore, the mere presence of a properly holstered handgun, even if it alarms another customer, does not automatically constitute a crime or even reasonable suspicion for a detention.
So the officer can't just detain the person with the gun?
Not based only on the fact they are lawfully carrying and someone else is alarmed. What the officer can do is approach the individual, perhaps engage in a consensual encounter, meaning a non-coercive conversation where the person is free to leave and maybe respectfully ask questions to understand the situation and perhaps ease the other customer's concerns. They should also observe the individual for any actual signs of criminal behavior or intent. Are they acting erratically, making threats, showing signs of intoxication while armed? Is the gun being handled improperly or brandished? If, based on the totality of the circumstances, not just the gun itself, the officer develops specific, articulable facts rising to the level of reasonable suspicion that a crime has been, is being, or is about to be committed, then a temporary detention, an investigative stop, would be justified.
And can they take the gun during this?
For safety during a lawful detention, yes. State law, CCP 14.03 days, specifically allows a peace officer, acting lawfully, to disarm a person at any time the officer reasonably believes it is necessary for the protection of the person, officer, or another individual. This is a temporary safety measure during the interaction. However, the handgun must be returned to the person if the officer ultimately determines the person is not a threat and has committed no violation resulting in arrest. So in this specific coffee shop scenario, simply being alarmed by lawful open carry is insufficient grounds for immediate police action beyond observation and maybe a consensual chat. The alarm itself isn't a crime by the gun carrier.
Moving on to scenario 9, consent to search after arrest outside. A subject is arrested outside his house based on a valid criminal warrant. He's handcuffed and secured in the back of a patrol car. An officer then goes back to the subject, still in the car, and asks for verbal consent to search his residence. The subject grants verbal consent. One officer then enters the residence and searches, while another officer remains with the secured subject in the patrol car. Was this search done correctly?
This situation raises significant Fourth Amendment red flags, particularly when you think about Schimel v. California, search incident to arrest, and the voluntariness of consent. First, let's address search incident to arrest. Schimel limits such searches to the arrestee's wingspan or immediate control area at the time of arrest. Here, the arrest happened outside the house, and the subject was then secured in a patrol car. At that point, the residence itself is clearly no longer within the subject's immediate control. So, a warrantless search of the home cannot be justified as a search incident to the arrest that happened outside.
Okay, so it's not a search incident to arrest, but the subject gave consent.
Right. He did give verbal consent, yes. But the critical question is whether that consent was truly voluntary and knowing, as required by the Fourth Amendment. Think about the circumstances. The subject is already arrested, handcuffed, and locked in the back of a police car. Is consent given under those conditions truly free from coercion or duress? It's certainly questionable. A court would look very closely at the totality of the circumstances to determine if the consent was voluntary or merely acquiescence to perceived authority. Even if deemed technically voluntary, the consent here was to search the entire residence, which is a much broader scope than a simple search incident to arrest would ever allow.
So what should the officer have done differently?
Ideally, to make the consent more legally defensible, the officer should have obtained written consent, perhaps using a form that explicitly states the subject understands their right to refuse. This provides much clearer documentation that the consent was voluntary and knowing, and that the subject understood they were waiving their significant Fourth Amendment rights regarding their home. Without clearer documentation or stronger evidence of voluntariness, given the inherently coercive setting, arrested in a police car, this type of search based only on verbal consent obtained after arrest and securing the individual is very vulnerable to being challenged and potentially suppressed in court. That secured in vehicle factor really impacts the perception of whether consent was truly freely given for a search unrelated to the immediate arrest scene.
Let's consider scenario 10. Suspicious vehicle matching description, car wash burglary. A homeowner calls police about a broken lock on their storage shed, possibly criminal mischief. They give a description of a suspicious vehicle and a male seen nearby earlier. Later that night, around 11:30 p.m., an officer on patrol sees a vehicle and a male matching that exact description parked at a closed self-service car wash. The officer knows this car wash is a frequent spot for burglaries of the coin machines. The officer calls for backup. As backup arrives, the officer sees a second man slumped down in the passenger seat. The officer orders both men out of the car for safety. As they get out, the officer looks inside the car from the outside and sees several bandanas lying on the front seat, each filled with jewelry, watches, and a large amount of loose change. When questioned separately, the two men give conflicting stories about what they're doing there. What's the legal justification for the officer's actions here? Step by step.
Okay, this scenario involves several legal principles stacking up nicely for the officers. Let's break it down. 1, initial detention, reasonable suspicion. The officer absolutely has reasonable suspicion to detain the individuals initially. Why? The vehicle and male match the description from the earlier criminal mischief call. They are present at a closed car wash known for burglaries, late at night, 11:30 p.m. These are specific, articulable facts justifying a temporary investigative detention, a Terry stop. Calling for backup is also a reasonable safety precaution given the circumstances and presence of two individuals. 2, ordering occupants out. During a lawful traffic stop or investigative detention involving a vehicle, officers are generally permitted to order the driver and passengers out of the car for officer safety reasons, Pennsylvania v. Mims and Maryland v. Wilson. So, ordering them out was permissible here. 3, Plainview Doctrine. When the officer looks inside the car from a lawful vantage point outside the vehicle and sees the bandanas filled with jewelry, watches, and loose change on the seat, the Plainview Doctrine kicks in. The items are in plain sight, the officer is legally positioned to see them, and their incriminating character as likely fruits of theft or burglary is immediately apparent, especially given the context, car wash known for burglars, suspicious circumstances.
So seeing the loot elevates things.
Exactly. That plain view observation elevates the encounter from reasonable suspicion to probable cause to believe a theft or burglary has occurred and that these individuals were involved. It gives probable cause for their arrest. 4. Search of the vehicle. Mobile vehicle exception. Once probable cause is established from the plain view and surrounding circumstances, the mobile vehicle exception to the Fourth Amendment warrant requirement likely applies. Given the probable cause and the inherent mobility of the vehicle, it could be driven away easily. Officers can typically search the vehicle, including containers within it, where evidence of the crime might be found without needing to get a warrant first. 5. Conflicting stories. The fact that the men give conflicting stories when questioned separately further solidifies the existing probable cause for their arrest. 6. Warrantless arrest power. Additionally, the suspicious place circumstance warrantless arrest power, CCP 14.03A1, could arguably apply here, given their presence at the closed high burglary location late at night, matching the suspicious description, combined with the plain view of suspected stolen property. So this scenario illustrates how reasonable suspicion can develop into probable cause through observation and investigation, triggering plain view, the mobile vehicle exception, and arrest powers, all justifying the officer's actions.
Okay, that was a good step-by-step. Let's go into some slightly different lecture scenarios mentioned in the handout, applying the principles we've covered. Lecture scenario 2. Spousal consent to search. Cocaine in cabinet. An officer is dispatched to a family fight. The wife meets the officer and is upset. She tells the officer her husband hid a baggie of cocaine in a specific kitchen cabinet drawer earlier. The husband is still at the scene, but he's currently being interviewed by another officer in a different room, say, the living room. The wife gives the officer consent to search that specific kitchen drawer where she says the drugs are hidden. Can the officer legally search the drawer based on the wife's consent?
This scenario directly tests our understanding of those spousal consent rules, specifically Georgia v. Randolph versus Fernandez v. California. Remember Randolph. If both spouses are physically present and one objects, the objection wins, and police cannot search based on the other's consent. However, the key fact here is that the husband, while still at the scene, is not physically present in the kitchen where the search is proposed. He's being interviewed in the other room. Therefore, under the clarification provided by Fernandez v. California, since the potentially objecting spouse, the husband, is not physically present at the threshold or location being searched to object at that moment, the wife's consent can likely be effective for the common area, the kitchen cabinet. So yes, the officer likely could search that specific drawer based on the wife's valid consent, as there's no co-occupant present and objecting right there. It's a subtle but important distinction based on physical presence at the point of the search request.
Presence is key. Got it. Lecture scenario 3. Child home alone marijuana smell. An officer responds to a 911 hang-up call at midnight. When the officer arrives at the address, a 7-year-old girl answers the door. She appears to be home alone. As the girl opens the door, the officer smells a strong odor of marijuana coming from inside the residence. The girl tells the officer her mom went to church about 3 hours ago and hasn't returned. She says she accidentally dialed 911 while playing with the phone. The officer asks the girl if he can come inside to check things out. Can the officer enter with the girl's consent? But if she doesn't consent, and once inside, if entry is lawful, what can the officer do about the marijuana smell?
Okay, several layers here. First, can the officer enter with the 7-year-old girl's consent? Absolutely not. A 7-year-old child clearly lacks the legal capacity, authority, or understanding to give valid consent to a search of a residence. Her yes is legally meaningless in this context.
Okay, so kid's consent is out. Can the officer enter anyway?
Yes, likely without consent, under the doctrine of exigent circumstances, or the related community caretaking function. The critical fact is finding a 7-year-old child home alone at midnight, reportedly for 3 hours. This immediately creates an emergency situation concerning the child's welfare and safety. The officer has a duty to ensure the child is safe, which justifies a warrantless entry to check on the child and the conditions inside the home. The 9/11 hang-up adds to the justification for checking welfare.
So entry is justified for the child's safety. What about the marijuana smell?
Once lawfully inside, due to the exigent circumstance, child welfare, the strong odor of marijuana becomes a factor under the plain smell doctrine, which is analogous to plain view. The distinct odor provides the officer with probable cause to believe marijuana is present in the residence. This probable cause, combined with the obvious child endangerment neglect situation, child alone with likely illegal drugs accessible, would allow the officer to take further action. This might include One, conducting a limited protective sweep of the home to ensure no one else is hiding or that there aren't other immediate threats to the child's safety. Two, seizing any marijuana or drug paraphernalia found in plain view or plain smell during that lawful entry and sweep. Three, most importantly, taking steps to protect the child, which would certainly involve contacting CPS and likely removing the child from the home until the parent is located and the situation assessed. The primary justification for the entry is the child's welfare, but once lawfully inside, the plain smell provides probable cause for drug-related investigation and seizure alongside addressing the neglect.
Lecture Scenario 4. School Locker Search. Marijuana reports. A high school principal receives multiple reports from credible students that another student, let's call him John, is selling marijuana from his school locker. Two students specifically state they saw marijuana in John's hand near his locker earlier that day. The principal contacts the school resource officer, SRO, relays this information, provides the SRO with a master key to the school's lockers, and gives the SRO John's specific locker number. What can or should the SRO do now? Can the SRO just use the key and search the locker?
This scenario perfectly illustrates that critical difference we discussed earlier between the search standards for school officials versus sworn law enforcement officers, SROs, in Texas. Under New Jersey v. TLO, the school principal, acting as a school official, likely has reasonable suspicion based on the multiple student reports and eyewitness accounts. That standard is likely met here. So the principal could probably use the master key and search John's locker themselves based solely on reasonable suspicion to maintain school discipline and safety.
But the principal gave the key to the SRO. Does that change things?
It potentially does, especially in Texas. Remember, the source material emphasizes that in Texas, school officers do not enjoy the same lesser standard. If the SRO, acting in their capacity as a law enforcement officer, conducts the search, they are generally held to the higher Fourth Amendment standard of probable cause. While the information from the principal and students provides strong reasonable suspicion, it might be debated whether it quite reaches probable cause needed for the officer to initiate the search.
So what should the SRO do?
The safest legal approach for the SRO would likely be one of two things. One, have the principal conduct a search based on reasonable suspicion, with the SRO possibly present as a witness or for safety. If the principal finds marijuana, it was found based on the lower standard applicable to school officials, and then the principal can turn the evidence over to the SRO. This avoids the SRO initiating the search under the potentially insufficient probable cause standard. Two, alternatively, the SRO could take the information gathered, student reports, principal's info, and use it to apply for a search warrant for the locker from a judge, arguing it now constitutes probable cause. Simply taking the master key and searching the locker themselves might be legally risky for the SRO if a court later determines they lacked probable cause and were acting solely as law enforcement. The principal searching first is often the cleaner approach legally in this context in Texas.
Lecture Scenario 5. Shoplifting at Target. Refusal to search purse. A Target store loss prevention LP officer observes a woman on security cameras take several DVDs off the shelf, conceal them inside her large purse, and then walk past all points of checkout and exit the store without paying. The LP officer stops the woman just outside the exit doors. The woman refuses to let the LP officer look inside her purse. The LP officer calls the police. When the police officer arrives, the woman still refuses to allow anyone to search her purse. What can or should the police officer do? Can they search the purse?
Yes, the police officer can likely search the purse under these circumstances. Here's the breakdown. 1. Probable cause for arrest. The store LP officer directly witnessed the woman commit the elements of theft, taking merchandise, concealing it, passing points of sale without mailing. This gives the LP officer probable cause for a citizen's arrest or detention until police arrive. 2. Police arrest. When the police officer arrives, they receive this firsthand account from the LP officer who witnessed the crime. This information provides the police officer with probable cause to formally arrest the woman for theft, shoplifting. 3. Search incident to lawful arrest. Once the officer has probable cause and makes the lawful arrest, they are permitted to conduct a search incident to arrest. As established by Schimmel, and even considering Gaunt's principles, this allows a search of the person and the area within their immediate control or wingspan at the time of arrest.
And the purse counts as being within her immediate control.
Yes. Generally, a purse carried by the person at the time of arrest is considered within their immediate control. The purpose of searching it incident to the theft arrest is twofold. Officer safety, to check for weapons, and, crucially here, to prevent the destruction or concealment of evidence of the crime for which he was arrested, namely the stolen DVDs believed to be inside the purse. Therefore, because the officer has probable cause for the theft arrest, they can lawfully search the purse incident to that arrest, even over the woman's refusal. Her refusal doesn't negate the legal authority provided by the search incident to arrest doctrine in the shoplifting context.
And finally, lecture scenario 6. Parents consent to search adult son's room. Parents call the police because they caught their 18-year-old son, who lives with them in their house, smoking methamphetamine in the backyard. The son fled the scene before police arrived. The parents tell the officer they are afraid he has more drugs or paraphernalia hidden in his bedroom upstairs. They want the officer to check his room. They give the officer consent to search the son's bedroom and say they are willing to press charges if anything is found. What can or should the officer do? Can the officer search the son's room based on the parents' consent?
This scenario really hinges on the son's age and the expectation of privacy an adult child has, even when living with parents. The key fact is that the son is 18 years old, legally an adult. As we discussed with third-party consent, once a child is an adult, the parent's ability to consent to a search of the adult child's private living space, like their bedroom, becomes much more limited. Generally, parents cannot validly consent to a police search of their adult child's private room, especially if that child has established some level of exclusive use or expectation of privacy there, like keeping the door locked, paying rent, etc., unless the parents can demonstrate they also have common authority over that specific room, meaning they frequently use it, store things there, etc., not just that it's in their house.
So just because they own the house isn't enough for the son's private room?
Usually not, once the child is an adult. The adult son has his own Fourth Amendment rights regarding his private space. Therefore, the officer generally cannot rely solely on the parent's consent to search the 18-year-old son's bedroom in this situation. However, remember the governmental action principle. The parents, as private citizens, can search their son's room on their own initiative. If they choose to do so and they find drugs or paraphernalia, they can then turn that evidence over to the police officer. Because the search was conducted by private individuals without police direction or participation, the evidence would likely be admissible.
So the officers should advise the parents of that option.
Yes. The officer's best course of action would be to explain to the parents that they likely cannot legally search the son's room based only on the parent's consent due to his age. The officer should gather all the information from the parents about catching him smoking meth, their fears about his room, to see if it rises to the level of probable cause needed to seek a search warrant for the son's room. If probable cause exists, getting a warrant is the proper route. If not, the officer could advise the parents that they have the option to search the room themselves and call back if they find anything illegal.
These scenarios truly bring home just how complex law enforcement can be on a daily basis. It requires officers to constantly weigh public safety needs, individual constitutional rights, and a whole body of legal precedent, all in real time, often under immense pressure. It's definitely far from a simple job.
Indeed. And it underscores why these rules and procedures exist. They aren't just bureaucratic hurdles. They're in place not just to guide officers' actions, but fundamentally to protect everyone's rights and the rights of victims, suspects, and the public. They're designed to ensure that the justice system operates fairly based on properly collected evidence and lawful procedures. Understanding these intricate layers, even just the basics we've covered today, helps us appreciate the complexity of their duties and the vital importance of critical thinking, de-escalation, and adherence to the law in every single police interaction right from the moment that initial call comes in. This raises an important question, though.
Right. And maybe for you, the listener, the next time you hear about a police response or see footage of an investigation unfolding, perhaps you'll have a deeper understanding and appreciation for the meticulous, legally constrained process that's supposed to be involved. What stands out most to you from today's deep dive? We covered a lot, from tactical approaches and scene security to the nuances of the Fourth Amendment, consent, and warrants. What further questions does this raise for you about that critical balance between ensuring public safety and protecting individual liberties in a free society? We encourage you to keep exploring these issues, keep questioning, and keep digging deeper into these vital aspects of our legal system and our society.